This is Chapel for November 27th, 1962. Dr. Staley is our speaker.
Instead of the responsive reading this morning, I am reading a passage which has been inspired afresh in my mind by the fact that three times lately in my general reading of current Christian literature, my attention has been called to the fact that nowadays, in our missionary understanding and endeavor, we should be emphasizing the universal and unconditioned love of God, and thinking not only of self and church and denomination, but of all men. And two or three times, especially by Dr. C.H. Hoang, who is the president of the Bible College in Tainan, and frankly, I think Tainan must be in Formosa, but I'm not sure. It's not Taiwan. But he called a special attention to this passage from the fourth chapter of Ephesians. You may recall that in it, Paul is talking about the unity of the faith, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. But then he goes on to tell how this God inspires the ministry of the whole church, and of course the ministry of particularly called ones also. He gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive, but, speaking the truth in love, may grow up into him in all things, him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. I would like to announce, before we bow in prayer, that Brother Chick Michael, the blind student, whom many of you know by sight at least, is in most serious shape at the hospital in Winston-Salem. He has had to undergo a terrific operation. The way it was described to me, they had to take off the top of his head, scrape the bone for infection. He is quite ill and quite despondent, I learned. I think it would be wonderful if those of you who know him especially would drop him a card and, if possible, go by the Baptist Hospital to see him. They say he longs to see some of us. This is his family, so to speak. And I'm sure we will be remembering him. Now I'm asking Brother Cedric Hepler, one of our graduates who is visiting us today, to lead us in prayer. And as he leads us, may we be conscious of this, our brother especially. Let us bow. I hope that many of you find in some hymns of the church the solace and the strength and the inspiration I find in the third stanza, especially of the first hymn which we sang, and in this whole hymn, especially that second phrase or clause of the last stanza, "and all the joys I have." it is a privilege, I think, that one may seize upon to testify that what joys he finds in life of real worth and of real depth and of real height, universality, are in connection with thought and feeling about Jesus Christ. I have other announcements, if you will bear with me, to make this morning, and then just a brief commentary on the scriptures, or at least inspired by the scriptures. Will the faculty especially and Wake Forest men notice this announcement? Dr. George J. Griffin, chairman of the Department of Religion of Wake Forest College, will be on our campus today and tomorrow. All Southeastern students who are graduates of Wake Forest College, their wives, Dr. Griffin's wife is coming with him, and so the wives are included. Their wives, members of our faculty and their wives, are cordially invited to meet with Dr. Griffin at an informal reception this afternoon between 4 and 5 in the Bethay Room. That's the lower room in the Appleby, or Music and Religion Building. Tomorrow, Dr. Griffin will be our guest in chapel, and I do hope that you will remind friends who are absent today to be here tomorrow. Also, tomorrow after chapel, we will have another one of those coffee breaks, we call them, for seniors. That is, all who will graduate in January or May or August this year. Come over and be with us for a simple chapel break. If your wife is in school especially, or if she can come, I think it'd be nice if you would bring the wife also. The faculty, of course, is included there with the seniors. And then I want to call special attention to a little book which I recommended first to the state convention meeting in Raleigh about 2 weeks ago, and have since ordered enough copies of to give a copy to each member of the faculty, and we are sending one to each member of our Board of Trustees. I wish that we could afford to give one to each student. It is called A Little Exercise for Young Theologians by Helmut Thielke, the German pastor in Hamburg, and I believe now chancellor of the university in Hamburg. At any rate, this little book has in it, I think, some things that will do us all a great deal of good as we strive to understand intellectual leadership, such things as academic freedom, and at the same time, the people whom we serve. We all recognize there is a tension there, and this man, I think, helps us see how it may be resolved. I do hope that each student will try to get one. I'm going to put at least 5 in the library, so I know that you can read it if you are willing to. May I say that you have to be careful the first chapter or two, because the meaning is somewhat vague at first, but read especially the last 5 or 6 chapters, and there are only 41 pages in the whole work, so it's not an onerous task. Let me read, if you don't mind, just a few sentences. Whoever ceases to be a man of the Spirit automatically furthers a false theology, even if in thought it is pure, orthodox, and basically Lutheran. Dr. Thielke, of course, is a Lutheran. But in that case, death lurks in the kettle. There's death in the pot, I believe we've heard a phrase like that in a Southern Baptist Convention recently. Theology can be a coat of mail which crushes us and in which we freeze to death. It can also be, this is in fact its purpose, the conscience of the congregation of Christ, its compass, and with that, all a song praise or praise song of ideas. Which of the two it is depends upon the degree in which listening and praying Christians stand behind this theological business. As a Christian, as a listening and praying Christian, each must fight not to be crushed by theology. And thus, instead of being a Christian soldier, becoming a corpse on the battlefield. Sacred theology, therefore, is not a word to be lightly taken upon our lips. Theology is a very human business, a craft, and sometimes an art. In its last analysis, it is always ambivalent. It can be sacred theology or diabolical theology. That depends upon the hands and hearts which further it. But which of the two it is cannot necessarily be seen by the fact that in one case it is orthodox and in the other heretical. I don't believe that God is a fussy fault finder in dealing with theological ideas. He who provides forgiveness for a sinful life will also surely be a generous judge of our theological reflections. Even an orthodox theologian can be spiritually dead, while perhaps a heretic crawls on forbidden bypaths to the sources of life. That, I think, engages our attention and inspires us to thought. A little exercise for young theologians by Helmut Thielicke. And now just a few words further, if I may. A few days ago, Mrs. Staley and I were discussing how little we knew because we have lived as we have lived, unlike the manner and the conditions in which and under which so many others live. And last night, as we looked at Dr. Kildare and saw depicted a case of drug addiction, two cases in fact, rather vividly pictured, I think, at the conclusion of the program, I said to Jesse, "Honey, what do you think of that?" And she said, "I hardly know what to think. I just don't understand that sort of thing." I said, "Well, this drug addiction is pretty bad. It's worse than I had imagined even." And then we went on to further conversation. And I said, "I feel so inadequate. I wouldn't know what to do with a case like that." And commented also that I didn't know even what to do with a case of alcoholism. I used to try to handle them, but I realized that all I could do was befriend, and that in an inadequate way. And I said, "After all, we have lived pretty sheltered lives, haven't we?" And she said, "You know, when Zarina, who is her sister and whose husband works in the oil fields as an architect," she said, "when Zarina was here the last time, she said to me, 'You and Sid live in an ivory tower. You don't know about the rest of us.'" Well, I am quite sure that any one of us would have to say that concerning many aspects of life. We are inadequate. We do not understand. We can hardly conceive the temptations and the conditions under which so many other people live. And of course, if one isn't careful, he can just sink down in despondency, frustration, and say, "I can do nothing." But I thank my God that for what I do know, I strive to have a message. For those parts of life which perhaps I understand a little, and for those who can understand me, I try to have a message. And last week, you have to bear with me now, last week I told you about my interest in talking to children and in letting them know that even in the church, that is to say the church hour, not the Sunday school hour of our weekly services, they are thought of and are made welcome by those of us who try to be pastoral and Christian leaders. We can express our love where we may be understood. We can express our love in our own circumstances. And it is one of the joys of my life that out of the 500 to 700 students who come to this seminary every year, There are some who understand phases of life that I don't understand at all. There are some who have suffered so that they can understand, sympathize with, and minister to others who suffer. There are some who have touched the world in some of its more irreligious areas and aspects. And they have something to say as Christians to the folk who live in those areas and under those conditions. What I'm trying to say is that in whatever way we can, in whatever way our message fits to whatever people we may be directed and among whatever people we may live, we have a Christian message. We have come to see the goodness of God in the land of the living. We believe in a Christ whose love is universal and unconditioned, and we may find in our ministry ways to express that love. I'm still interested this morning in children, and if you'll bear with me, I'll give you one or two further illustrations. First, about that kind of love, the kind of love that is adequate for our particular needs. Dr. E.C. Ruth, the father of Porter Ruth, who is our big secretary in Nashville, told me one time of an experience with his daughter. She was in college, and she was living in a girl's dormitory. And the girls that she knew best were having a party one night, and she wanted to go. Dr. Ruth lived in the same town, and he told her, when she asked about it, that she could not go, that that was not the kind of party he wanted her attending, and so he prohibited it. He said he had a little room upstairs in that girl's dormitory temporarily, and he went up to cry over the fact that she was hurt after he had forbade her going. And he stayed there quite a while thinking about it and getting control of himself. And then he came down to the parlor or reception room in the dormitory, and his daughter was musing musically on the piano. And as her fingers drifted over the keys, she came to play the notes of "O Love That Wilt Not Let Me Go." And he said she fingered that quite a while as he sat there. And he went over to her and said, "Honey, do you realize what you're playing?" And apparently she actually had not realized. It was just a song she knew, a tune she knew by habit. So. And then when she became conscious, he said, she jumped up from the piano stool and grabbed him around the neck and said, "Daddy, I know it's because you love me that you don't let me go. I know that." And he said they had a real reunion of heart and spirit there. So there is a love that will not let us go. There is a love that commands us, but his commandments are not grievous, as we read in the book of Hebrews. They are for our good. They are for our guidance. They are for our peace, our inner strength and selfhood. Perhaps another story which I have used will be appropriate here. Mercy, a little colored girl, 8 years old, was setting the table when the son of the house who was in the room said to her, "Mercy, do you pray?" The suddenness of the question confused her a little, but she answered, "Yes, I do, every morning and every night." "Do you think God hears you?" the boy asked. And she answered promptly, "I know he does." "But do you think," said he, trying to tease her, "that he hears your prayers as readily as he hears the prayers of white children?" For full 3 minutes, the child kept on with her work. Then she slowly said, "Master George, I pray into God's ears and not to his eyes. My voice is just like any other girl's, and if I say what I ought to say, God don't look at my skin." And the little commentary is, in these days, even the boys and girls need to learn such lessons as this. And again, a little poem which I have often used, which is appropriate, I think, to the general idea of trying to love all people and express that love in whatever way is appropriate for us. It's called Three Gates of Gold. If you are tempted to reveal a tale someone to you has told about another, make it pass before you speak three gates of gold, three narrow gates. First, is it true? Then, is it needful? In your mind, give truthful answer. And the next gate is last and narrowest. Is it kind? And if to reach your lips at last, it passes through these gateways three, then you may tell the tale, nor fear what the result of speech may be. Is it true? Is it needful? Is it kind? Many a one of us would grow in grace and ministry if we would give attention to that. And then finally, and I'm thinking now only of the fact that there are some lessons which we can bring to children and apply to adults also, I'm going to read this one called The Bell and the Lights. Once upon a time, there was a judge whose bench was in the city, but whose bed was in a quiet village with no very modern inconveniences. And the judge had a friend who was president of an electric light and power plant. And the friend visited the judge and said unto him, "That is a fine old knocker thou hast upon the front door, but thou mightest just as well have an electric bell that would ring in the kitchen." And the judge inquired, saying, "Where could I get the juice?" And the friend said, "A very few dry batteries would take care of that." And the judge became interested, and he got some wire and some dry batteries and an electric button, and he did his own installation, and he soon had a bell that would ring in the kitchen when the button was pressed at the front door. And he said to himself, "This is fine." And he got to studying about electricity. And he said, "I might just as well have electric lights." So he bought some more wire and a lot of dry batteries, and he bought some electric light bulbs, and he bought another button. And when he had tinkered sufficiently, he pressed the button, expecting that the whole place would be flooded with light. But there was no deluge. And he tinkered some more, and he got no light. And he wrote a letter to his friend, the president of the Electric Light and Power Company, and inquired, saying, "Why is it thus, and what is the cause of this thusness?" And the president of the Electric Light and Power Company replied, saying in his epistle, "My dear judge, when thou art as old as I am, thou wilt learn that it requireth much more power to produce a light than it does to make a noise." Now, when I heard this truthful story, I said, "The judge is not the only man who should hear that epistle. The world is moderately full of men who have not yet learned that distinction." And as I think about these simple little stories and their possible application, I say to myself again, let us find ways to speak the truth in love, that we may minister not only to ourselves and to our churches, but to all men everywhere in the world. It is possible, when we love each other and work together as Christians, for the church to exercise a ministry as a whole church, and for us as special ministers to encourage that greater ministry. May we pray. Our Father, give us the resolution as Christian leaders to use whatever talents thou hast given us, whether apostles or prophets or pastors or teachers, so to apply ourselves in love that we glory in doing what we can in our individual places for thy name's sake, and for the uplifting of the minds and lives of men. For Jesus' sake we ask it. Amen.